Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our very first look at a new-to-us case this week. As always, before we get going, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as my largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie, Samantha, Matthew, and Betty. Again, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. You can also make donations to the show. Two ways you can do that. One is through PayPal. Just send it to ian@corpsecreekpublishing.com or through Cash App, $ITOTTEM. Both are great ways to help the show upgrade equipment such as microphones and computers. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the day. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. All right, so now, as I said in the introduction, this week we are going to be taking a look at the infamous series of murders known as the I-45 murders, or more popularly as the Texas Killing Field murders. If you've never heard of these murders, I'm going to give you a very brief overview. At least since the early 1970s up into the early 2000s, over 30 young women have gone missing in and around the area of I-45 between Galveston and Houston along the Gulf Coast. Specifically, a lot of these young women and girls have disappeared from around an area called League City. I first became aware of the spate of murders in the early 2000s, and over the last few decades, I occasionally poke my head back into this case to see if there are any new developments, as for me, it's a fascinating case. Many of these murders that we're going to be discussing have never been solved, and I generally speaking try to stay away from unsolved murders here on the Deathcast. I think that others cover these types of crimes much better than I do, such as my buddies over at the True Crime Garage, who really put their heart and soul into covering missing and unsolved murders. But the Texas Killing Fields is one of those cases that I have just continuously found myself drawn to again and again. Now, the area that we're going to be talking about in Texas is in the southeast along the Gulf Coast between Houston and Galveston. If you've never been to Texas, areas of the state such as this, there is a lot of rural, flat fields, swamps, small communities that are separated by miles with nothing in between them. It's very desolate. More so in the early 1970s, when these spate of disappearances and killings are first thought to have begun. This area is known for its refineries. It's also a quasi-vacation destination, so there are a lot of people moving in and out of the area in an almost constant stream. There was a movie based on these murders that came out some point in the early 2000s. A lot of people shit all over it. I thought it was an interesting film, really piqued my interest into looking into these cases. For me, part of that is the fact that it gives such a graphic depiction of just how desolate these fields that we're going to be talking about are, how you can be inside of them. People driving by on the road will neither see nor hear you if you happen to have something going on in there. And there were a lot of things going on in these fields, the most famous of which is the Calder Field Road, where a number of bodies have been discovered. Now, as best as I can tell, the first young woman who is linked to this spate of killings is a 13-year-old by the name of Colette Wilson, who disappeared on June 17th, 1971. Now, on that day, Wilson was standing on the intersection of Highway 6 and County Road 99, which is located northwest of Galveston. For those unaware, Galveston is actually an island, so people in this area routinely referred to Galveston as the island, and those who lived in Texas proper as mainlanders. So Wilson found herself standing at this intersection in what has been described as a sparsely populated area known as Alvin, Texas, at 12:30 on the afternoon of June 17th, 1971. She had just attended a multi-school band camp, and her instructor had dropped her off where Colette was to wait for her mother. It's known that she was wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and portable shorts. She was last seen carrying her clarinet as well as a file of sheet music. Colette was the second oldest of nine children. As such, her mother had a bit of an ordeal getting out of the house that day. However, Colette had instructions from her parents that should her mother be late, Colette was to walk to the home of her best friend, who lived not far from where her music instructor had dropped her off. Colette was dropped off, estimated at 12:30 p.m. Her mother arrives around 12:36 p.m. When Colette's mother arrives at this intersection, she does not see her daughter. However, she sees a car pulled off on the side of the road with a man inside of it, and she later would tell authorities she believed that the man had possibly broken down. Not thinking that anything could be the matter, Colette's mother then drives further down the street to Colette's friend's house. Learning that her daughter has not been there, Colette's mother drives off, passing the intersection where her daughter should have been waiting for her, only to find that the car, which had been there only moments before, is now gone. Mrs. Wilson returns to the house. She said she was anxious on the return drive, and is immediately upon getting back to the house, she phones her husband, Tom. Then the family contacts the police, who basically brush the Wilsons off. We've discussed this before, how during this point in time, the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, the police would routinely tell parents that their kids are probably a runaway or are off doing drugs with their friends and not to worry about it, and that, you know, if they just sit tight, their kid will probably return home. Which basically translates to, we're not going to do anything about this, and there is nothing that you can say or do to make us do anything about this. It should be noted, however, that the police did tell the Wilson family not to go and bother the media with this story of their missing daughter. More likely than not, this is the police trying to forestall any sort of investigation into this young girl's disappearance, as they see these types of cases as a bother more than as something that they need to put their attention on. It's not until the 19th that the police in Alvin, Texas, agree with the family that something is almost certainly wrong with this situation, that it appears that Colette Anise Wilson has in fact disappeared. More likely than not, has been kidnapped. We do know that Colette's mother gave a description of the vehicle that she had seen at the intersection where she was to pick up her daughter. We also know that someone found the stub from an unemployment check at this same intersection and gave it to the police. However, the police threw it away upon receiving it. Now, Claire Wilson, Colette's mother, later stated that it seemed to her that even though the police admitted now that they had a missing person, they did very little in terms of trying to locate her daughter. Undeterred, the Wilsons, their next-door neighbors, as well as other friends of the family, began in earnest to try and locate Colette. And eventually the family is able to raise $10,000, which they put up as a reward for any information leading to the discovery of their daughter. Despite the fact that the police in Alvin were doing very little, the state troopers and Texas Rangers are eventually going to get involved in this case, although they too are unable to uncover anything. Obviously, the family hears many false leads during the months that Colette is missing. One such lead leads her father to visit Louisiana, as he had been told that his daughter was seen there. However, nothing happens during this trip. So as all of this is happening and the month of June passes, no one in the Wilson family is aware that another young girl is about to go missing. This would be Brenda K. Jones, age 14, who was an African-American child. Brenda was described as an outgoing young woman who intended to be a teacher when she graduated from high school and got her certificate. Brenda was last seen walking near Galveston Hospital, which is not far from I-45. Describing the family, one of Brenda's three sisters said that their mother was widowed at this point, that they had moved into a housing project on Galveston Island, and that they'd led pretty sheltered lives, that Brenda was on her way to visit her aunt in Galveston on the afternoon of July 1st, and that when she did not return home that evening, they immediately contacted the police, who told them that they needed to wait to see if Brenda came home before anything could be done. I have read different stories as to the date of when Brenda's body was actually found. Some list it as July 2nd, the day after she disappeared. Others have it that Brenda's body was actually discovered on July 12th. In any event, a crew of painters was working on the Pelican Island Bridge from scaffolding when one of the men noticed something in the water of Galveston Bay. Eventually, they see that is in fact the body of a woman, The police are contacted at 10:30 a.m., informed that what appears to be the body of a woman has been seen in the water. The police arrive, and what they find is a young African-American woman who, at this point, they list the age as being around 20, her wrists and ankles bound with long plastic shoelaces. The confusion over the victim's age is quickly dispelled as one of the officers who arrives a few minutes after the others recognizes the victim as being Brenda K. Jones. So the police contact the family and inform them that unfortunately their daughter has been found. She is now dead. The family is devastated by this. And according to Brenda's sister, they did their best to reconstruct what had occurred on the day that Brenda had gone missing. They had attended Mass early in the morning, with Brenda staying afterwards to teach Sunday school, after which the family had a meal, and Brenda informed her mother that she wanted to go to the University of Texas Medical Branch's John Seeley Hospital to visit their aunt who had recently fallen and broken her leg. Brenda's mother had given her bus fare. It's known that she took the bus to the hospital where she saw the aunt and then left. According to the bus driver who routinely drove this route, Brenda got back on the bus near the hospital and then got off a few blocks from her house at the corner of Avenue I, which is currently known as Seeley Avenue and 31st Street, where she was last seen walking in the direction of the family's home. The police questioned the family, trying to discern whether or not Brenda had any known enemies, and it quickly comes out that no, she had no enemies, and the family cannot think of anyone who would have wanted to do harm to the young girl. The following day, a autopsy is performed on Brenda's body, where it's discovered that a pair of women's underwear had been forced inside of Brenda's mouth, with the coroner later stating that it was his belief that the underwear had been placed into her mouth after Brenda had died. The body was found to have no signs of rigor mortis, nor was there any sign of trauma on the body, leading the medical examiner to speculate that Brenda had been thrown into the water either from a boat or a pier, and had only died a few hours before her body was discovered. It's eventually determined that Brenda had most likely been manually strangled by her killer, as upon a closer examination of the body, it's determined that she has, in fact, suffered bruising around her neck. As with Colette, the police had very few clues to go on. Not even a witness who could come forward and say that they had seen Brenda near a car. Now, in the decades since Brenda's murder, some have speculated that it's possible that Brenda and Colette may have been murdered by the same individual, citing the fact that both girls played musical instruments. However, no evidence has surfaced to indicate that this is in fact the case. However, what is the case is that the summer of 1971 was not finished with reaping sorrows upon those who lived in and around Galveston, Texas. On August 4th of 1971, two 14-year-olds' friends, Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Lynn Shaw, both from Webster, Texas, which is located in southeastern Harris County, is bordered to the north by the city of Houston, to the northeast by Nassau Bay, the southeast by Clear Creek, and the southwest by League City. Webster is the border of Harris County and Galveston County. One thing we need to understand with these cases is that all of these disappearances end up falling under the jurisdiction of different law enforcement agencies, which, especially at this point in time, the early 1970s, means that there is going to be no coordinated effort by law enforcement, not like there would be in this day and age, where law enforcement would be putting information about these crimes onto a computer and other law enforcement agencies around the country, but specifically in the Galveston metropolitan area, would be able to see this information and contact those other agencies to see if there are any similarities in their crimes. In any event, Renee and Sharon had gone to one of the beaches in Galveston. It's known that the two girls had gone to a place called the Wicks Ski School, which gave people ski lessons, but would also take them out into the bayou and allow riders to go once around on the skis, pulled by the proprietor's boat for a single dollar. It was said that this was a very popular hangout for teenagers in the area who enjoyed water skiing. So Sharon and Renee go there. They are told that the boat would not be going out that day because the waters were too choppy, and one of the Wicks' neighbors would later state that they saw the two girls walk from the ski school and head towards 61st Street, which is a main thoroughfare through Galveston that leads to Seawall Boulevard as well as the beaches. Both girls were known to be avid swimmers, skiers, and surfing. The proprietor of Wicks' ski school stated, quote, "They weren't regulars, but they'd show up sometimes. They came once or twice before that day. They weren't locals, they were rounders." Now, according to the wife of the proprietor of Wicks' school, who gave this statement, the term rounders means that they were both attractive girls who were street smart. By early evening, when neither girl had returned home, their families became concerned. However, in subsequent interviews, individuals associated with both families stated that there was a feeling among all of them that Renee and Sharon may have run away, as friends of theirs had recently left the Galveston area heading for Texas, and both girls had expressed an interest in following suit, eager to see the beaches in California and to surf them. And while the police appeared to have done little in their efforts to find either of these girls, their families were acutely aware of their absences. According to a friend of theirs who was a few years older and lived in League City, which is roughly 5 minutes south of Webster, both Renee and Sharon, who lived next door to each other and were rarely apart, were fearless girls who were preparing to enter their freshman year in high school. Now, this friend, who his parents had money, who had her own car, recounted to journalists how they spent nearly all their time together, how her home was something of a party house where Renee and Sharon could often be seen, and that the two teens had tried marijuana once. They were more interested in being at the beach, men, that type of thing. And that although she constantly tried to dissuade them from doing so, Renee and Sharon constantly would hitchhike, even when this friend of theirs would offer them rides. Now, on the day that Renee and Sharon went missing, she said that she and two male friends had arrived in Galveston and run across the two girls. She said that, as usual, the two girls had spent the previous evening together, had hitchhiked to Galveston, and had hung out with her and her two male friends. She let them know that she'd be able to drive them home later on that day. However, she could not do it earlier, which seemed to distress Renee and Sharon a little bit, as they had to be back home by 1 o'clock, as one of their parents was calling to make certain that they had followed their orders and were at home when they were supposed to be. This friend dropped them off outside of a hotel and let them know that they would meet them back there at 5:30 if they were able to get back to Galveston, at which point they would drive the two girls home. And it's at this point that we know that Renee and Sharon end up inside of the white van. Now, later that afternoon, when this friend returns, she is unable to find the two girls, and thinking that they must have decided to spend the night sleeping on the beach in Galveston, something that this woman stated all of them did that summer on numerous occasions, she put the matter from her mind. However, the next day, when there was still no word from either of the girls, she began to think that they had actually carried through on a plan they had been talking about for some months, and that was to run away to California. As two older men that Renee and Sharon knew had left for that area recently, and with the approach of high school, something neither girl was looking forward to, they began to talk of it incessantly. This woman said that talk of high school really seemed to dampen their moods. Eventually, the parents began to call this woman's home, and she made up excuses about how they were just there, or they were sleeping, that sort of thing. Although, eventually, this changes when days pass and there is still no sign of Renee or Sharon. Police began to come around asking questions. However, they have no information to give. It isn't until Sharon's mother stops at this young woman's house, demanding to know where her daughter is, that she realizes the severity of the situation and explains to Sharon's mother that, in fact, she has not seen her daughter since the day that she went missing, August 4th. However, she agrees to help Sharon's mother locate the two teens, driving her around to the areas that she knows that Renee and Sharon hung out in. She stated that even after Sharon's mother stopped coming around the house, she herself would on occasion cruise the streets of Galveston looking for the girls, because in her mind, they needed to get home and let everyone know that they were okay. The best that I can tell is that everyone who knew the girls was absolutely devastated by their disappearances, and fear actually began to set in a few months later, as you will see. We now have four young girls in three different towns who are all missing. This isn't getting a lot of media coverage in the area, as people are going about their lives, and missing children during this point in time in America, unfortunately, were not seen as that big of a problem. Whereas today, this would be front page headlines from coast to coast if, you know, four girls went missing in the span of 3 months. There would be talk on the news about a possible serial killer, as well as online, with people speculating and online sleuths trying to help these families discover the whereabouts of their daughters. The next victim to go missing occurred in October of 1971. This one actually breaks the MO that had previously been established in that the victim is a 19-year-old by the name of Gloria Ann Gonzalez. She disappears on October 28th, 1971. From Houston, Gloria was last seen near her apartment on Jacqueline Street. Gloria, who worked as a bookkeeper in a nearby Kroger store, was reported missing by her roommate. Unfortunately, as with so many of these cases, the police told Gloria's roommate that she would just have to wait it out. Gloria was 19 and could come and go as she pleased. Obviously, the police are not interacting with one another. They're not connecting any of these cases. Even when the next young woman goes missing, this is Allison Ann Craven, who was 12 years old. Allison ends up going missing about 10 days after Gloria Ann Gonzalez on November 9th, 1971. According to Allison's mother, she had gone out grocery shopping and had been gone for about an hour. When she returned to their Houston apartment, Allison was simply not there. She, too, reports her daughter missing and is told by police that she will simply have to wait. Then another double disappearance occurs, which really starts to bring some attention to these crimes. On November 15th, 1971, Debbie Catherine Ackerman and Marie Talbot Johnson, both aged 15, were attempting to hitchhike to Houston from Galveston, Texas. Similar to Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Lynn Shaw, Debbie and Maria both loved swimming, water skiing, and, according to some accounts, surfing. Debbie came from a family with two older brothers. She was the only daughter of German immigrants and was born on the island of Galveston. Marie Talbot Johnson, sometimes listed as Marie Andrews Johnson, was the daughter of a gynecologist and a homemaker. Her parents had divorced, which led the family to move often, which eventually leads to the Johnsons moving to Galveston's when her stepfather gets a job there. Both girls quickly became friends over their shared love of the water and were known around Wick's Ski School. The owner of one of the local surf shops said of them, quote, "They'd come in and hang out with other kids. They were nice girls. They were dating a couple of the guys who came to the shop." Now, it's known that on the date of their disappearance, Debbie got into a fight with her parents as she wanted to spend the weekend over at Maria's house rather than stay home and help her mother with chores. She said that this was because it was a holiday on Monday. According to some sources, the Ackermans did not like the friendship between Maria and Debbie, as they felt that Maria was much more worldly than Debbie was and was, in fact, a bad influence on their daughter. When Debbie didn't get her own way, she instead went to her father and asked if she could spend time at Maria's house. Her father gave her permission. However, this ends up leading to an argument between her parents. Debbie ends up leaving, spending the weekend at Maria's house. On Monday morning, she contacts her father asking if she can spend the school holiday with Maria. And her father relents. However, he tells his daughter that she needs to be home by 3:15 that afternoon. It's known that the two girls spent the day running around Galveston. One report states that they were seen near a local Baskin-Robbins at Galveston's Port Holiday Mall at around 11:15 a.m. when two girls working the counter recognized them and called Maria and Debbie over. It was noted by these girls that Debbie had a small suitcase with her. When they were asked what they were doing, both girls replied, quote-unquote, nothing. After leaving the Baskin-Robbins, the two girls working the counter kept their eyes on the pair, and very soon it became apparent to them that the girls were hitchhiking. In statements given to police later, both of these young girls stated that after a short period of time, a white van driven by a white man pulled to the side of the road, and both Debbie and Maria got inside, entering through the passenger side door. When the van pulled away, one of these young women stated that she noticed curtains in the back windows of the van blocking any view of the interior. We've covered a lot of cases where a young woman or a young man climbs inside of a vehicle with a stranger as they are out hitchhiking. It's obvious where this one is going. Debbie and Maria are not going to be seen again alive. Debbie's father becomes frantic when his daughter does not return home by 3:15 that afternoon, eventually reaching out to Maria's mother around 4 p.m. and learning that neither girl was there. The families exchanged phone calls throughout the rest of the afternoon into the early evening. The Johnsons had little to say beyond the fact that they had last seen both girls at roughly 9 a.m. that morning. The following day, Maria's stepfather contacted the Texas Rangers to report both girls missing, while the Ackerman family contacted their sons who were away at college and asked them to come home and help look for their sister. Both families began searching in earnest for the girls, with the Ackermans going to the beach and the mall, areas that they knew both Debbie and Maria hung out in. However, nothing was gleaned from any of these trips. The Galveston police actually put out a be on the lookout for both girls, something that they had failed to do in any of the other disappearances. Obviously, the Johnsons and the Ackermans are, besides themselves, trying to discover what could have happened to their 15-year-old daughters. Unfortunately, the following day, November 17th, the police receive a phone call in the mid-afternoon from an elderly man who had been out fishing in an area called Turner Bayou. Now, Turner Bayou is located on the mainland near Texas City, just off of the I-45 corridor. This particular piece of land during this period of time was accessible by a dirt road that was closed with a locked gate. It was owned at that point by Humble Oil. Police quickly converge on the scene as this elderly man has stated that he has found a body in the water. Arriving on the scene, the police are greeted by a fairly horrific sight. There was a body in the water that was partially submerged over by a wooden bridge that extended out across the bayou. officers are able to pull the body to shore. The victim had reddish brown hair, was wearing a pink bra that was visible through a maroon blouse. It was noted that she had pierced ears and rings on her fingers. However, from the waist down, the victim was naked. It was more, however. Officers noted what they believed were bullet wounds to the body, particularly around the right side and center of the neck. As with Brenda Jones, this victim was bound at the hands and ankles. Later that evening, the Johnson family receives a phone call from the Texas City Police Department. They arrive, and while they are unable to see the body that has been discovered, the jewelry that was found on the corpse is still at the police station, and they immediately recognize it as belonging to their daughter. However, as of yet, there was no sign of Debbie. The coroner estimated that Maria had been in the water for approximately 36 hours, believing that she had been murdered sometime late Monday or early Tuesday morning, so roughly 10 to 18 hours after she and her friend had disappeared. Canvassing the area, police talk to an ear witness who states that they heard gunshots coming from the oil field sometime on Monday evening. Amazingly, there is a concerted effort by both the Galveston and Texas City Police to attempt to locate Debbie's body, with officers from both departments converging on Turner Bayou. I do need to warn you that this next piece of information is a little bit graphic, as a firefighter who was on the wooden bridge where they had found Maria's body saw something sticking out of the water along the bayou's edge about 110 yards from where he was standing, and this turned out to be the naked rear end of a young girl. Unfortunately, this is going to turn out to be Debbie Ackerman. As with Maria, Debbie was found wearing the top she had last been seen in, although she was naked from the waist down. Her hands and ankles were bound with shoelaces, and she was still wearing the jewelry that she had on the last time she left the Johnson household. However, there was no sign of the suitcase that Debbie had been carrying. Now, we have a number of victims at this point. It's November of 1971. Three of these victims have been found with shoelaces or some other type of binding on their wrists. I think if we were able to get access to these bindings, we may discover that they were in fact tied by the same individual. I think that it's more than likely that at least these three victims, Brenda, Debbie, and Maria, all fell victim to the same perpetrator, and it is very possible that all of these victims that we have covered so far in this first episode have probably been the victim of this same individual as well, as while not unheard of, it's very unlikely, especially at this point in time, the early 1970s, that we've got two serial killers operating in the same geographical area, targeting the exact same type of victim, that being young girls. Now, there are cases from California and Louisiana, just to name two, where serial offenders were in operation targeting the same type of victim. However, as I stated a moment ago, those cases are few and far between. And in many of the ones in California where this occurred, more than any place else, prostitutes with drug problems were the main target and were an easy target for the various perpetrators, such as the South Side Slayer and the grim sleeper Lonnie Franklin Jr. People who lived in the Galveston area during this point in time said that the discovery of Debbie and Maria's bodies was the first time that anyone in the area became aware of these murders, that a series of murders, or disappearances at this point, as we have only recovered three bodies, was taking place, and that with the news of the discovery of Debbie and Maria, the young girls in the area began to feel a sense of dread. One of those things that really isn't spoken of, but is more felt and shared among each other without a word having to be said. Now, the day after Debbie's body was found, the chief of police for Galveston held a press conference wherein he said that it was believed that the motive for the killing of the two girls was sexual in nature. He also went on to inform those gathered reporters, not only local reporters, but also reporters from the larger cities in Texas, that Debbie and Maria were not the only victims who had been found deceased that summer. He brought up Brenda and the fact that she too had been found with her hands and feet bound, but also that she had been discovered naked. The medical examiner also granted interviews wherein he stated that both victims had died from gunshot wounds, and it was his belief that Debbie had died first while possibly attempting to shield Maria. The police did their best to try and track the girl's last known movements, and what it revealed was rather shocking for both families, as it was discovered that on August 3rd, this is the day before they went missing, Debbie and Maria were both seen at a mall in Texas City where they were looking for a birthday card for Debbie's boyfriend. They returned to the Johnson household via cab. However, Debbie forgot her purse in the back of the cab, and at 8 o'clock that night, the two girls were then seen at the cab stand where they retrieved this purse. They slept at Maria's house that night, after which their movements were tracked from the Johnson household to the mall, at which point they were both seen getting into the white van. Maria will end up being buried in Plainview, Texas, while Debbie is going to be buried in Galveston. And as reporters are covering Debbie's funeral services on November 24th, a man is going to make a discovery near the Attix Reservoir. The Attix Reservoir is west of Houston and north of I-10. It is a heavily wooded area that contains a bird sanctuary and a man-made lake that is used for flood control. Now, this man was out there in the woods with a metal detector when he came across what appeared to be human remains. The man left the sanctuary and drove to a nearby house, at which point he contacts police, who respond. They begin to search the area that the man indicated that he had seen the remains in, and it's at this point that they locate a human skull, something that authorities had not realized was missing, as they only gave the body, which was skeletal at this point, a cursory glance. However, upon further inspection, it was found that the body was wearing a white knit pullover and striped slacks, along with a ring that had the word love written on it. Now, the body is going to be transferred to the morgue, where it was determined that the body had lain face down in the woods for an extended period of time, and that the decapitation had happened after the victim's body had lain there. He believed it was due to animal predation more than anything else. However, the medical examiner, did note that it was extremely odd that the body, while skeletal, was still clothed in decomposing flesh, but that the skull was completely denuded of any tissue whatsoever. Examining the skull further, the medical examiner noted that there were fractures, indicating that it was quite possible that the victim, who is eventually going to be identified as 19-year-old Gloria Ann Gonzalez, had likely been bludgeoned to death. Now, something that perplexed the pathologist was the fact that in the decapitation, the lower jawbone or mandible had been left with the body, while the upper portion of the skull had been removed and was found a distance away. What perplexed him, however, was the fact that a number of teeth had been knocked out of this mandible, and these teeth had been collected by the searchers, and the medical examiner began to insert them into the open cavities on this lower mandible so that they could get a dental x-ray and hope to identify the victim. However, as the medical examiner is doing this, he comes across a molar that does not fit Gloria's mouth. Obviously, law enforcement is now thinking that there is almost certainly another victim out there near the attic's reservoir. So, a few days later, authorities return to the area, this time in larger numbers and with tracking dogs, to see if they can find any other bodies. Among those who were at this search was the sheriff, a man by the name of C.V. Buster Kern, who many said in later years was absolutely eaten up inside from this series of senseless murders. Now, at roughly 10:30 that morning, November 26th, the sheriff was making his way through the forest and grass when he saw a pile of bones lying atop some decaying leaves. This was roughly 50 to 60 yards from where the body of Gloria Gonzalez had been found 3 days prior. As with Gloria's body, a ring was recovered along with these skeletal pieces, and this ring spelled out the word peace. Bringing the body back to the medical examiner's office, some of the officers began looking through missing person cases, and in doing so, they came across Colette Wilson. And in their initial briefing to the police, the Wilsons had informed them that their daughter was wearing a ring on her finger with such a word on it. No skull was discovered with Colette's body, however, the lower mandible was discovered, and eventually this is going to be used to help identify Colette. Fortunately, the dentist who is going to identify the teeth and jawbone as belonging to Colette was actually her father, as he was a dentist, but he was also her dentist. So I cannot imagine the trauma of having to do such a thing. First your daughter is missing, then they find a body, and then you must, using your skills, identify that body by the teeth to confirm that it is in fact your own daughter. This finding along with that of Gloria, is going to send shock waves across the state of Texas as all of the major newspapers and media outlets are going to pick it up with headlines such as "Authorities Seek Link in Houston Isle Girls' Deaths." Here's where things, which are already very odd in this case, take a turn. A few days after the discovery of Colette's body, searchers in the reservoir come across another human head. Now, the pathologist who had been looking at Gloria Gonzalez's body had initially noted that it appeared to him that the skull was found at the time her body was recovered came from a young Caucasian woman, not from a woman of Mexican descent. And it's going to be learned that the skull which was found on that first day, in fact, belonged to Colette Wilson. The other head which was found is going to be from Gloria Gonzalez. Now, it's not unheard of for animals to ravage human bodies. I do think, however, that it is highly unlikely that two bodies found so close together would both be decapitated in such a similar manner, and I firmly believe that it's very possible, if not probable, that the killer came back to visit these bodies after the fact and removed these parts from his victims. For the causes of death, the medical examiner is going to state that Colette Wilson died from blunt force trauma to the head, while Gloria Gonzalez, who had been discovered with a 2-foot length of cotton cord wrapped around her neck, which was then passed around a 4-inch piece of wood that had been used to tighten this rope, cinched tight around her neck, meaning Gloria Gonzalez had been killed by ligature strangulation. All of this is going to have a profound effect on the Houston-Galveston area, as parents are in full-fledged panic mode with the discovery of these 5 bodies so close together, but also with the other young girls who are missing. That would be Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Lynn Shaw and Allison Ann Craven. These deaths are going to get a lot of attention, not only in the state of Texas, but the nationally syndicated CBS Evening News is also going to pick up on these murders and broadcast them nationwide. Now, the police initially did have a suspect in this spate of murders. However, it turns out that this individual was one of those serial confessors, an individual who puts himself into a crime simply to get attention. But law enforcement was not deterred, although they did investigate all of these crimes separate from one another. I honestly do believe that if some form of task force was formed at this point in time, they may have caught the individual or individuals that were responsible. However, as you're going to see in subsequent episodes, while some individuals are going to get brought to justice for some of these murders, the majority of them are going to remain unsolved. We are going to end the show at this point. We're at the end of 1971. There are 8 young women who have gone missing, with 5 of them having been recovered dead in either the waterways or the fields in between Galveston and Houston, Texas. I hope that you guys are enjoying this first episode in the series. I look forward to your input. And as always, stay morbid!